From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, getting a gun, going to prison, going back to prison, then finding meaningful work and staying straight. We talk with 21-year-old Andre Red Vaughn. He did time twice on Rikers Island, the biggest jail in North America. Now he works with a program that mentored him when he was released. Later we'll hear from Clinton Lacey, Associate Executive Director of the program, Friends of the Island Academy. We'll also hear an excerpt of the audio documentary that Vaughn made about his life as part of the Youth Portraits Project, which helps young people who have been in prison by giving them the tools to tell their own stories. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg reflects on President Bush's use of the word evil. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Pentagon is defending a missile strike that killed at least three men last week in Afghanistan. The missile was fired last Monday by a pilotless drone aircraft operated by a CIA agent who targeted the men by watching video from the drone's camera. U.S. officials say the men may have been members of Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network, but local Afghans say the men were simply peasants who were collecting scrap metal to sell. Rear Admiral John Stuffelbeam, a Pentagon spokesman, said U.S. forces went to the scene and recovered evidence, including ammunition and commercial airline schedules. The State Department says that Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has sent a letter to Secretary of State Colin Powell responding to U.S. concerns about an arms shipment apparently headed for Palestinian territory. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
Israel discovered the weapons last month, loaded aboard a ship in the Red Sea. The discovery caused a rupture in relations between Yasser Arafat and the Bush administration, not least because the administration says there's credible evidence that the weapons came from Iran. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says the letter was delivered over the weekend to the U.S. Consul General in Jerusalem.
We see it as a positive letter. We're currently studying it. I would nonetheless point out that, as we've said many times, actions must follow words.
The administration has been demanding a full explanation of the arms shipment from Arafat, believing that officials of the Palestinian Authority were involved. Boucher would not describe the contents of the letter, except to say most of it dealt with the weapons shipment. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
High winds forced a delay in today's scheduled run of the women's downhill ski race at the Winter Olympics. American skier Peekaboo Street was scheduled to race today. The Justice Department is beginning a national sweep to find hundreds of thousands of foreigners the government believes are in the U.S. illegally. Quinn Kleinfelter reports from member station WDET.
The FBI, federal marshals, and immigration officials plan to round up an estimated 314,000 foreign visitors to the U.S. who face deportation hearings but have yet to turn themselves into authorities. About 1,000 of those aliens are convicted felons. The INS routinely conducts searches to find aliens whose green cards have expired, but this latest effort has taken on extra significance in the wake of September 11th. The government is compiling a national database of individuals linked to alleged terrorist groups. Authorities are focusing in particular on the Detroit area, home to the largest population of Arabs outside the Middle East. About a third of all new customs agents hired will be stationed in Michigan. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 141 points to close at 9,885 in active trading. The NASDAQ gained 28 points. This is NPR News. The head of the nation's number three automaker complained today that Japan is giving its automakers an unfair advantage by systematically devaluing the yen against the dollar. Dieter Zetsch, who heads the Chrysler side of Daimler Chrysler, said the Japanese action could have serious implications for the U.S. economy. He quoted one analyst as saying that the devaluation of the yen could give Japanese automakers an advantage of as much as $1,400 per vehicle. Folk singer Dave Van Ronk has died at the age of 65. Van Ronk was a central figure in the Greenwich Village folk boom of the 1960s and was an early mentor of Bob Dylan. NPR's Melissa Block reports.
Dave Van Ronk was known as the mayor of McDougal Street, the heart of the Greenwich Village folk scene, back when there was a coffee house and a stage on every corner. Van Ronk recalled the time in an interview last summer.
It was mostly exciting because we were doing what we wanted to do. We were getting away with it.
Van Ronk's music mixed ragtime and jazz with country blues, all delivered in his husky growl. When a 19-year-old kid named Bob Dylan came to the village in 1961, Van Ronk put him up on his couch and helped him learn guitar, much as he continued to support younger musicians throughout his life. Dave Van Ronk died Sunday after battling colon cancer. He was 65. Melissa Block, NPR News, New York.
Police in London say a robbery at Heathrow Airport today may have been an inside job. The robbers got $6.5 million in U.S. currency. Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Wellington Management, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Rikers Island is the biggest jail in North America. My guest, Andre Red Vaughan, has done time there twice. He's 21, and like many of the young people who have done time there, he's from a poor inner-city New York neighborhood. But he appears to be one of the lucky ones. After his second stint at Rikers, he found work that matters to him. He works with the group that helped him turn his life around, Friends of the Island Academy. It provides transitional support to young people who have just been released from Rikers. It was founded by the first principal of the prison high school and is devoted to breaking the cycle of crime and incarceration. We found out about Vaughan through Youth Portraits, a project that gives voice to young people who have gotten out of Rikers by helping them tell their own stories in short audio documentaries. Here's an excerpt of Vaughan's piece, which was co-produced by Youth Portraits director Stacey Abramson and David Miller.
What's up, y'all? This is Andre Vaughan, but most people call me Red because I have red hair. Actually, I had a lot of names in my life. This is the story of how I got those names and how I gave them up. I grew up in the Bronx. I didn't know my father at all, but my mom's was like my best friend. She had her own name for me, Carrot Top. We were poor, but we had a close family until I turned 9. That's when my mom got addicted to drugs. My older sister Dawn was 14 years old when she figured it out. She walked in on my mom smoking crack.
She was in her bedroom. You know, when you're doing things, you don't hear a person coming. So I just opened the door and I saw her smoking a pipe. I stood there and she dropped in and she closed the door in my face. After that, it got worse. You get addicted to the drugs and you can't stop. So as much as she got addicted to the drugs, she forgot about her kids.
She used to be out all the time and we would literally like have to go around in the building to try to get somebody to give us food or something like that. I went to my uncle and told him, instead of him giving me the money, he took me on a robbery with him. It all started out with a phone call. He was like, listen, I got something for y'all down on 115th Street. It's a number spot, and we just left the house. It was like real work. Someone called us for something, and we went to work. We walked in. We never wore masks, because if you wear a mask, you look like you're about to do something. So he turned around and pulled out the gun and started patting the people down that was in there. So I came in, went under the desk. The money was stacked, so when I went to grab it, it fell over. So I'm in there picking up every dollar. So when we came out the building, I was standing there with my uncle because we never ran from the robbery. So we walking and a group of people was looking at us and they was coming after me and I wasn't gonna let them get me. So I just shot into the crowd and ran. The first thing my uncle said to me, he talked to me like I speak to my bosses now whenever I do something right. He was like, yo, man, you handle yourself well. That's good. That's going to take you places. And I made a career out of it after that.
An excerpt of Andre Red Vaughan's Youth Portraits documentary. Youth Portraits is part of Sound Portraits Productions, whose work is often heard on NPR. We invited Vaughan to talk with us about his story. What did having a gun mean to you?
Everything. Because if anybody ever owned a gun or walked the streets with a gun, you know that it gives you like this kind of power where you feel like you're more powerful than anybody. And in some sense, you are, because you have a gun and most people don't walk the streets with guns. So, you know, it gave me this kind of power, especially like if I pulled it out on somebody or you know, like I said, I used to rob like, you know, these big time guys. And for me to pull out a gun and see these dudes cower, you know, and, you know, they just, you know, go into, like, this little shell. It gave me, like, this kind of rush. So, you know, to carry a gun was a big thing for me. It was important. I didn't leave the house without it.
Where would you keep it when you were walking the streets?
I had a holster, but then I lost the holster, so I just keep it in my waistband, in the front or in the back.
Did all your friends know what you were doing, that you were doing robberies, that you had a gun, and what did they think of it?
I didn't have any friends.
You didn't have any friends?
No, I just had my uncle. Gun was my friend.
So you weren't even a gang or anything?
Yeah, the first time I was incarcerated, I was in a gang. The second time I came home, I was not in a gang. But when I was in a gang, I didn't consider them as my friend either. In some weird kind of way, they was like my backup.
Right.
And, you know, I felt I was doing more for them than they was doing for me.
In the tape that you made, the tape of your own story, you said that you knew you'd eventually get caught or that someone would eventually shoot you, and you didn't expect to live long. How did you feel about the probability of dying young?
I mean, I knew with the life I was living, I knew it was going to happen. So, you know, it was just a matter of time on when it was going to happen. You know, I really didn't think too much about it, but I knew it was going to happen eventually.
And you just accepted that?
Yeah, because I wanted to live the life. So I accepted it.
Did you have friends who died when they were young, while you were still living that life?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I didn't have too many friends, but there's a lot of guys that I knew.
Right.
And actually people that was friends before I started doing these things that were, you know, killed. A lot of the guys I knew was killed actually doing the same things I did. And, you know, it didn't change the way I was thinking. I learned from their mistakes.
What kind of robberies were you convicted of?
I wasn't convicted of a robbery.
Oh.
I never was caught for no robbery.
What were you caught for?
I was convicted of a gun charge. I got caught with a gun actually going to a robbery.
I see. What was your first time in prison?
My first real, when I was young, like 13, 14, I used to do like little 90 days here, 30 days here for like petty larceny and stealing and things like that. But my first real long stint was I did a year on Rikers, and that was the gun charge.
Mm-hmm. Rikers Island is a penitentiary just off the coast of Manhattan, or off the coast of Queens, I guess I should say.
Yes, it's in East Elmhurst, Queens.
Yeah. Would you describe your first reaction that first time you walked into Rikers Island?
I was scared.
Of?
I was scared because I was out of my element. I mean, in all actuality, I was surrounded by people who were just like me, but I was out of my element because, you know, in the street, people feared me, people were scared. You know, actually, I thought it was respect. And once I got to jail, you know, everybody there was there for doing the same things I did. So, you know, I was just a regular guy again. And that's actually what I was scared of.
How much fighting was there within Rikers Island when you were there?
Man, a lot. I mean, a lot. I'd say I fought almost, if not every day, almost every other day. Because it's regular things, everyday things that you fight over.
Like what?
Like how right now, like how this morning when I wanted to get up and brush my teeth, I just went in the bathroom and brushed my teeth. On Rikers Island, you got to get up, and if someone, you know, your toothbrush might not even be there, someone else will take your toothbrush and, you know, sharpen it and turn it into a weapon, or someone will take your deodorant, or, you know, it's little things like that that you do on an everyday basis out here. It's something you had to fight over on Rikers Island.
And was each time somebody took your toothbrush or something like that, was that like a challenge? And unless you kind of confronted the person, you'd be seen as weak?
Yeah, because, you know, it's just like out here, man. They'll start with the little things, you know, and then it'll turn to big things because they'll be stealing your toothbrush one morning or your deodorant, and the next day they'll be stealing your clothes, and the next day it'll be your phone time, and then it's your commissary. So if you don't nip it in the bud when it first starts happening, then it's going to happen. It's going to continue to happen.
And is there anybody who could prevent that from happening?
I mean, the COs can prevent it from happening, but they ain't too enthusiastic about doing that.
So what was the worst thing that happened to you in terms of one of these fights or one of these challenges?
I was cutting my back and I was cutting my arm.
Mm-hmm.
I was coming out of the commissary and someone, because actually this is when I had joined the gang, and I was blood. And we at Bloods have beef with Crips, Latin Kings, and, you know, mostly all other gangs. And a Latin King had asked me for my commissary when I came out the commissary room. And I told him no. and he went to snatch the bag, and I backed up from him, and I pulled out a razor first, and he spit a razor out of his mouth, and then he swung the razor. I put my arm up to block it, and he cut me on my arm. I swung the razor back. I cut him in his face, and that's when the CO started rushing out. And when the CO started rushing out, I ran, and one of the guys he was with cut me as I was running in the back.
After the fight, were you supposed to tell the authorities exactly what happened? And were there times when you did, or times when you didn't want to tell?
You never could tell. You never could tell because, I mean, on Rikers Island, it's like you, if you get known as a snitch, then you, and you're not going any place, so, you know, that just makes your time even harder. Mm-hmm. So it's either you handle it yourself or don't handle it at all.
Tell me what it was like when you got out. Like, where did you go after you were there for, what, a year?
Yeah. They, I went back to my sister's house. My sister was actually in a shelter. And I went to live with my uncle, the guy that had originally gave me the gun. I went to live with him. And we did the robberies a little bit more. But then I just was like, you know, I don't want to do this anymore because I didn't want to go back to jail. And my sister had moved out the shelter into an apartment, and I went to live with her. And she had her and a couple of my cousins and friends had told me about the mall upstate. I went up there, and I had got a job at the store, and I was getting paid about $6.50 an hour. And I got paid, like, every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks, I brought home, like, $300. And, it just wasn't me. I wasn't used to it, you know. In some weird way, I still had that criminal mentality. So what I started doing was I started taking credit card numbers, account numbers off the off people's credit cards and taking them and making it. It's just another machine you have. You just take it and copy everything into this machine, and you can make a brand new credit card identical to the one that you had, identical to the one that you took the information off of, and you can use it. So I started doing that with a female up there, and I did that for a while, and I actually got caught for that too.
And you went back to prison for that?
Yes, I did.
How much time?
They gave me another year.
At Rikers?
No, I was upstate. Actually, I thought I wanted to go back to Rikers because this is the place I was used to when it was close to home. But they didn't agree. They said if I did the crime up here, I had to do the time up here.
Was it different being in a prison outside of the inner city?
Yes, it was.
What was different?
Well, actually, for one, you know, the city guys was kind of like the enemy up there. So it was like I had like the whole jail against me, and there wasn't too many city guys in there. And I just, like, was out of my element. I didn't know, you know, I didn't know what was going on around me. I didn't know nobody up there. My family, my friends is, you know, about an hour and a half away. It was just, you know, everything was just too different for me.
And I think you were arrested, you served time a total of 3 times, is that right?
Altogether. If you add up all the time I ever did it, it was up to 3 years.
Did you end up back at Rikers again?
Yes, I did. After I came home from the second bit, I ended up at Rikers again.
My guest is Andre Red Vaughn. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Andre Red Vaughn. After being incarcerated twice on Rikers Island, he's now working with Friends of the Island Academy, a group that provides transitional support to young people who have been released from Rikers. Can you figure out what it is that changed, that made you want to stop stealing and stop carrying a gun?
Over the time that I was incarcerated, I had like missed like so many things. I missed my nephew's birth. My sister was going through a lot of problems without me there. My mother had passed away, and like I said, I had met this girl named Ebony, and I really missed her. I wanted to be home with her, so when I got home, you know, I put all these things into play, and my sister was like, you know, we need you around the house. You can't leave like that. You know, you could keep going to jail. You're not helping at all. You're making things worse. When I came home, I laid in the house for about a year Actually 14 months I laid in the house. You know, I didn't do anything. I just was there.
And then?
I went to, like, all of these different programs. You know, everybody's telling me, stay out of trouble or you're going to be dead or in jail. And these are things I already knew, so I felt I didn't need the programs. And Ebony, my girlfriend, went to this guy in her church and spoke to him, and he invited me down to a program. And I went down to this program, and this was, like, the total opposite of all the programs I've ever been in. The atmosphere was different. And, you know, I felt it once I first, like, walked in there, because the guy that I met, his name was Mark Washington. And I was expecting some guy to come in with a suit on, you know, telling me about what college he went to and why he went there and what's going on, you know. And it didn't work out like that, because he came out and, you know, he was just dressed like me. He had braids, you know, he gave me a pound. And, you know, I was like, you know, this is different, you know. He wasn't too young, he was only like 25. So, you know, it was different. I saw myself in him, you know. I was able to relate to him more than I would relate to anybody else.
You mentioned at the beginning of your tape that you had been very close to your mother until she became a crack addict. Now, I know she's since died. What happened? Did she die of an overdose?
No, even when my mother was a crackhead, I was still close to my mother. I was always close to my mother.
I see.
And she didn't die of an overdose. Dealing with the drugs had affected her kidneys. And actually, she lost one, and she was on dialysis. And we knew that it was going to happen anyway, because the doctor didn't give her long. And, you know, we begged her to stop. You know, she tried, but she kept going back. And then finally she stopped. You know, we became a family again. She started coming back into our lives. She met my nephews and everything, but it was, you know, too late, because the drugs had already took a toll on her body.
Were you ever angry with your mother because she hadn't been able to take care of you when she became an addict?
I never was angry with my mother. My brothers and sisters had animosity towards her. They felt that, you know, it was her job, she's not doing her job, and she's doing this. But I never felt anger towards my mother, even when she was doing it.
How come you didn't?
Because that was my mother. I don't see how anybody could ever be, you know, or be angry toward their mother or have any kind of animosity toward their mother. I never did. I always loved my mother, even when she was on drugs.
Did you ever do crack yourself?
Never. I used to feel that at some point in time when my mother was doing it, I used to feel like something was wrong with me. I used to feel like something was wrong with me and everybody else that didn't do it because my mother was doing it. My mother was like this angel. She couldn't do no wrong in my eyes. So if she did something that everybody else didn't do it, I felt they was wrong. Or I used to feel, what's wrong with me? Why am I not doing it? But it never got to the point where I did it. And actually, after she died, I vowed to never, you know, touch it, sell it, anything.
So it was okay for you to carry a gun, but you wouldn't go to crack?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds crazy, but yeah. I vowed to myself never to sell crack, to touch it, to have any dealings with it. But it was okay for me to carry a gun.
Do you live in the same neighborhood now that you grew up in?
I still live in the Bronx. I don't live in the same neighborhood I grew up in, though.
Is it the same? Do you live in the same neighborhood now that you were living in when you started robbing?
No. I mean, I pass through there. I see people from there. And sometimes I go visit, but I don't live there anymore.
Is it good to be living in a different neighborhood so that you're not involved with the same people and they don't have certain expectations of you?
It really doesn't matter where I move, because it's somewhere, it's people doing what I do everywhere. It just matters now that I just stay away from it. Even where I live now, I still see some of the people I did these things with. I run into people that I've did these things to, but it's just, you know, it's just how I distance myself from them.
Do any people from the old neighborhood make fun of you for going straight?
Yeah, all the time. They call me angel, they call me an angel, they ask me why I'm not out there getting money anymore. They say I changed. But, I mean, it doesn't matter now. I set my own standards.
Well, let me ask you about money. I'm sure you were making a lot more when you were robbing than you are now.
Yeah, definitely.
Give us a comparison of what you made then and what you're making now.
Well, back then I was, let's just say, you know, one robbery in 3 minutes, I could get $3,000 or $5,000. And now I would have to save up to get that kind of money.
What's the hardest part about living on your salary?
It's not really hard. It's just like sometimes it's not really like my salary. It's just like being on my own, like without doing a crime now. You know, sometimes it get hard, or like I might get backed up in the bill or something, or I might not have money to do what I want or to, you know, get certain things. But, you know, it's some of the stresses of the criminal life is gone. Like, you know, I don't have to worry. Like, if the cops stop me, I can pull out my job ID and tell them where I got the money from. You know, I don't have to worry about them watching me. I don't have to worry about guys I robbed or anything coming back after me or want revenge. It's just like so many different things that I don't have to go through now, which makes this life much easier.
How do you feel about the police? Do you have strong feelings about the police one way or another? And do you ever feel like that they're your protectors?
I never felt like the police were my protectors, because every time I seen the police, they were doing something to me. Mm-hmm. Any contact I ever had with the police, they were doing something to me.
Of course, you were doing a lot of illegal things, and they were doing their job and doing something to you in a way, at least some of the time.
Yeah, some of the time. Some of the time it wasn't. It's just, you know, I don't have any feeling towards a cop. And I actually feel like they're the biggest gang in New York.
And you still feel that way?
Yes, I do.
Is it hard for you to stay out of trouble now?
No. No, it's not. When I first got with this program, it was kind of hard because I was still, like I said, I was in the neighborhood. And when the guys teased me and things like that, I felt bad, or I felt like, you know, in some weird way I was turning my back on them. But it's different now. I don't feel that way now. I didn't turn my back on them. I turned my back on the game. It's just that they're still in it.
Andre Redvoin is now a peer educator with Friends of the Island Academy and a teaching assistant for Youth Portraits Project. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Audi and the all-new A4. Information is available on the web at AudiUSA.com or 1-800-4-AUDI. And Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Founding Brothers, The Revolutionary Generation by Joseph J. Ellis. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, we continue our conversation with Andre Redvoin, and we meet Clinton Lacey, Assistant Executive Director of Friends of the Island Academy, the program that helped Vaughn after he was released from Rikers Island. Also, language commentator Jeff Nunberg reflects on President Bush's use of the word evil. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Andre Red Vaughn. He served two sentences in New York's Rikers Island, the biggest jail in North America. Now at the age of 21, he works with the group that helped him when he was released, Friends of the Island Academy. It provides transitional support to young people who have just been released from Rikers. Now, I know you're working for Friends of the Island, the program that is for young people who've gotten out of Rikers Island Penitentiary. Have you had other jobs since you went straight?
No, I haven't.
If the point comes when you're looking for another job, are there things that you're worried about because you have a record? You know, are you worried that you'll be, that no one will want to hire you?
Yeah. Actually, I've been on numerous interviews where I've seen them read down my application and everything is cool until they get to the part where it asks if I was ever convicted of a felony. And, like, their whole facial expression changed. These are things, like, I used to notice on an interview. And sometimes I'm afraid that if Friends wasn't there, I don't know what I'd be doing now.
Right.
Because I have two felonies, and before Friends, I didn't know anything about a job. Keeping one or anything. Like I said, the previous job that I did have, people got for me. And I wasn't able to handle it. So I don't know, you know, where I would be without Friends.
What kind of work do you think you'd want to do? I mean, do you want to keep what you're doing, the kind of counseling of young people who are in trouble?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, because I feel like I have to give back. I mean, it's just the right thing to do. I mean, sometimes, you know, this is the wrong thing, this is the right thing. You know, it may not be what you always wanted to be in life, but it's the right thing to do. I'm giving back. I took from the community. I was just, you know, this monster in the community doing all of these things, taking away from my people. And it's like I got a chance to give back now, so why not give back?
You know, I think for everyone who's been a victim of a crime, you ask yourself, how can someone have done this to me and they don't even care? Like, it doesn't bother them that they hurt me. It doesn't bother them that they stole the money that I worked so hard for and that I really need. They don't care. How can they not care? Can you answer that question?
First of all, anybody who gets into who does crime or who gets into that kind of life, you know what you're doing wrong. So what you have to do is it's kind of like you block it all out. It's kind of like you just make yourself numb to all feelings, because emotions and feelings is a weakness. You know, because you can't. How could you sell drugs to somebody if you feel bad for it? How can you rob somebody and take money from them if you're going to feel bad later? So it's kind of like just give yourself this numb feeling and not care what goes on.
So now that you're not robbing and you're not carrying a gun, do you still do that numbness thing?
Actually, I still get that rush and I still have that numb feeling, but it's like the total opposite now. The numb feeling I have is towards the people who still do it. And the rush I get now is from, like, if I do a presentation, and a little kid comes up to me and is like, yo, you know, here's my number. Can you call me or can I talk to you and things like that? It's kind of like the same rush I used to get from pulling out a gun on somebody.
So it just sounds like such a complete difference to see emotions as being really weak, emotions as a sign of weakness. It just must, like, be a really different life or change you a lot to, like, let in some of those emotions that you had to block out.
Well, actually, last year I was on the other side, because last year I was mugged, I was robbed.
Oh, really?
And it kind of bugged me out, because, like you said, I was on the other side of it, and I was like, you know, I had just got my paycheck, I just have had my money, and it was like these guys just came up to me, and you know, they pulled out their gun, and I'm looking. First, they was young, so I'm looking at them like, you know, get out of here, get out of my face, you know, I did this, you know, way before you guys' time, and it's like, but. They was, you know, they was like me. They was persistent. They was not trying to hit me, not giving them the money. So they approached me with the guns, and I did what people used to do when I approached them. I gave them the money. You know, and it was hard for me to handle, because I you know, the feeling I had was, you know, okay, I changed my life around. I'm not going to be this person anymore. I'm not going to be that person anymore, but I'm not going to be a victim neither. And, you know, I realized that when you're a victim, it's, you know, you're a victim. It's nothing you could do.
What did you do afterwards? Did you report it to the police? Did you try to go after them?
I don't deal with the police in any way. So I didn't call the police. The police saw what they saw. They didn't see what would happen, but they seen me. And they seen those guys, so they have figured that something happened. But they didn't go back for those guys. They came after me. And, you know, they asked me if I had ID. I didn't have any ID because the guys took my wallet. And, you know, they was kind of like, they was beefing with me. They had a problem with me because I didn't have any ID, you know. And it was like, you know, what happened? They thought it was a fight or something. And it wasn't.
So it was interesting to be on the other end, huh? To be on the victim end instead of the robbing end.
Yeah, I can't handle it.
You can't handle it? Is that what you said?
No, I can't. I mean, I handled it and I had to, but, I pray that never happens again because I can't handle it.
Right. Well, one of the things you've done recently is a fellowship with Sound Portraits, which is a group that does real terrific stuff for public radio. And you've done like a mini documentary about your own story. It's like a narrative of your story, and you've interviewed some of the people in your life, like your sister and your girlfriend, for this tape. Just tell me a little bit about the process of actually reflecting on your life, especially after this long period of being numb, of not wanting to think too much. Now having to go back and really reflect on your life and think about it, tell the story of it. What was that process like, and what do you feel like you learned from it?
Well, I learned a lot. Besides like the technical stuff of how to edit and things like that, I learned a lot. I learned a lot from like my family because, you know, when I had the microphone, I put the microphone in, you know, my friends, my family, and my girlfriend, and things like that. They told more to the mic than they told me.
That's a really interesting phenomenon, isn't it?
I mean, it is, but it's true. You know, they told, like, I found out how my sister really felt about my mother when she was on the drugs. You know, I found out how my brother really felt. I found out how Ebony felt when I was locked up, you know. She told me more about how her parents felt when I was locked up. You know, I just found out, like, so many different things. And it was a good experience for me because a lot of these things I didn't know. And if I wasn't doing this project, I probably would have never found out. They probably would have never brought up.
Well, Andre Vaughn, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
No problem.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Andre Red Vaughn is now a peer educator with Friends of the Island Academy. We'll meet the assistant executive director after a break. If you'd like to hear more of Vaughn's audio documentary about his life and the audio documentaries of other young people who have been incarcerated on Rikers Island, you can listen on the website youthportraits.org. This is Fresh Air. My guest Clinton Lacey works with young people who have just gotten out of Rikers Island, trying to help them break the cycle of crime and incarceration. Lacey is the assistant executive director of Friends of the Island Academy. It was founded by the first principal of the Rikers Island High School and provides transitional support for young people who have just been released from jail. Lacey has worked with the program since 1992. I asked him where he begins with a young person who has just entered the program.
We begin to have a conversation with them about, yes, looking at their communities, looking at the pathology, you know, the long list of ills that they face in their communities, that their families face, and actually acknowledge that that's where most of them are going to return. So then, and we also will spend some time talking about putting that in some kind of historical context, trying to find some cause for that. But at the end of the day, once that understanding is achieved, you know, we still needed to do something to empower them to survive it, to somehow negotiate through that. And so that really points to them changing themselves, changing the way they view themselves. So instead of becoming victimized, or instead of being part of the problem, instead of cooperating in the cycle of incarceration and the cycle of substance abuse and what have you, that they could begin to make alternative choices, begin to make different decisions.
One of the things that Andre said in the interview was that it was really exciting when he first got a gun, and it got him respect. Do you have to work a lot with young people when they get out of jail in Rikers Island to help them find other ways that they can get respect without carrying a gun?
Yes, that's one of the most important issues for them and for us, this concept of respect. And so we do something when we go out to Rikers and other places. There's an exercise called Two Sides of the Street. And what we do is we basically ask the young people to help us describe one side of the street, the side that they're really quite experts in, and they can talk about what is respect on the side of the street where there's violence and drugs and what have you. And not just describing what respect is, but describing what success is. And so we start listing issues on that side of the street, such as carrying weapons, selling drugs. You know, how do you resolve conflicts on that side of the street? You know, 9 times out of 10, violently. What takes place on that side of the street? What are relationships characterized by? You know, lack of trust and always looking over your shoulder for danger, running from the police, the threat of death and violence and incarceration. And then what we begin to do is, and after we've really exhausted that list and listened to them, we begin to construct another side of the street and describe what's over there. So while on one side of the street there's fast money, quick money, illegal money, we describe on the other side of the street what we call steady flow, or the idea of getting paid every 2 weeks, and discussing what is credit and what is financing. And so we start to transition from what exists on one side of the street and start to show what can exist on the other. So in terms of respect, on one side you need to carry a weapon or you need to have people fear you. But on the other side of the street, respect is really based on something else like admiration and love and camaraderie. And so we began to help them make that transition.
Now, Andre was telling us that the first time he got out of Rikers Island, he got a job in a shopping mall in a store, and he started forging credit cards. He stole credit card numbers from customers and then managed to forge cards.
Right.
He went back to prison for that, and it was only subsequent to that that he decided to seriously go straight. I imagine that happens with a lot of people who ultimately succeed, that it takes a while, just like mm-hmm. stopping smoking takes a while to really give it up. But so I'm wondering, when you try to help people who've gotten out of jail, help them land a job, what do you tell potential employers? Because they would have every right to be worried that there might be some slip-ups.
Yeah, if I could just back up one moment, and which to the first part of your question was just about that issue of it took like an intervention like jail, you know, for people to, you know, finally wake up or finally make some changes. It's something that a story that we use a lot in our work is the story of Malcolm X and how it was in jail that he began to transform himself, and he read the dictionary and began to educate himself. And he said that if he hadn't have been arrested, he was surely headed to get himself killed in the street. And a lot of the young people talk about that they were on a path. And not to say that it's a good thing that they were arrested, but it also speaks to the lack of other interventions that are out there to prevent them in the first place. So yes, for a lot of them, it was after their first, second, or third incarceration that they finally say, okay, something has to change. But then back to where that question led in terms of employment, it's a struggle. I mean, there are certain employers who, as soon as it is shared or revealed that the person has a criminal background and particularly a felony, then it's just a closed door. What we've done is spend a lot of time going out, hitting the pavement, forming relationships with employers, talking to them, trying to build the relationship where they would give young people a chance, and also guaranteeing them that they've gone through a pretty extensive workshop where they, you know, have everything from interviewing skills to, you know, punctuality and working with others. Most recently, we're getting ready to begin to get our young people bonded, which is a great incentive for employers in terms of worrying about theft and things like that.
What do you do when you and the people you work with have mm-hmm. worked very hard to get one of the young people placed in a job? And this, we're talking about a young person who's recently out of jail. You get them the job, and they screw up. They steal or they stop showing up. And I'm sure you feel very responsible to the employer because you've maybe given your word that you work closely with the person, you have faith in them, and they've let you down. How do you deal with them afterwards?
Well, it's something that we've had to deal with a lot. More than stealing as such, much more prevalent has been just the leaving the job, you know, lack of retention, mm-hmm. that they've either, you know, being late or not showing up or dealing with conflicts on the job, taking directions from supervisors. And so, yeah, it really is a struggle to work with the young people and also to maintain an open door and an opportunity to place more people on certain jobs. When they do fall down on the path, when they do lose jobs, it's not the end of the road for them. You know, we help pick them back up, dust them off, and get back at it again.
When you do pick them up after mm-hmm. somebody has let you down, mm-hmm. what's your attitude in terms of being very understanding or being very tough about not allowing that to happen again?
Well, the toughness is in the standards. Okay, so we set high standards for them. And so the toughness is in the consistency and the clarity of what's expected. But the love and the compassion is in that we keep coming back to the table. It's like, okay, look, this is where you made a mistake. Now, this is what you have to do. And so you have another chance. For us to, you know, close the door on somebody, for us to say, all right, that's it. This is it. We're not working with you anymore, which has only happened in really a couple of extreme cases, means that we were the last stop for them. You know, the youth that come to our program, most of them, they're not accepted back into their high schools. They're not accepted back into other institutions that they may have been affiliated with, if they were indeed aligned with any other institutions. And so that we become not just the program, but in many senses, the community. And sometimes the family. And so it's the kind of attitude that a family, you could imagine that a family would have with their child or with one of their loved ones who continues to fall on the path, continues to get in trouble. They continue to try to work and find solutions to those issues.
You're working with young people who are from poor backgrounds, who come from violent neighborhoods. Are you from a neighborhood like that yourself, or are you from a different kind of background and had to, in a way, learn the language that the young people you work with speak?
Right. I was very fortunate to have had, you know, both parents in my home growing up, and I am the son of two educators, and so they were able to provide for us both a relatively comfortable, you know, material existence, you know, certainly, you know, nowhere near wealthy or anything like that, but, you know, comfortable, not worrying about when we were going to eat or getting clothing, and certainly not living under the constant threat of violence and what have you that characterizes the young folks that we're talking about now in the communities that they come from. So, no, I didn't grow up in a community like that. I didn't grow up having to face the things that they faced. I was able to have a childhood, unlike these young folks. So, that, though, as far as I'm concerned, I've never seen that as a barrier to working with young people. The language, the culture is not something alien to me because the experience of black folks in this country, the experience of black and Latino folks, I think is somewhat of a family affair, you know. And so, you know, there was not really slang that was alien to me. And there certainly was a cultural gap. Certainly the first day walking into Rikers Island, for me back in 1992, I didn't know what to expect. And I knew that, no, I had never spent time at Rikers Island. And so, you know, I certainly was questioning my ability to do this work. So I've always set limits. I've always, I think, you know, received respect. And I've rarely ever been accused of being soft or not knowing what's happening or anything like that, you know, because that's just a perception of some people who haven't seen other types of people, you know? So if all they've seen is television, or if all they know is what they've heard about people who aren't from the hood, right, or whatever, then there's perceptions. The same way people outside of the hood have a whole set of perceptions about people in it. So I think it's through the experience of actually working with people, interacting with people, where they say, hey, there's different types of people out here. There's something called balance, you know? And so you don't have to be a sellout. The two extremes, it's not either being a sellout or being a thug, right? A so-called thug or a so-called sellout. You know, there's something in between those extremes that's a healthy way to be.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Clinton Lacey is the Assistant Executive Director of the Friends of the Island Academy, which provides transitional support for young people who have just been released from Rikers Island. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on President Bush's use of the word evil. This is Fresh Air. The evil one, axis of evil. President Bush has been using the word evil to explain his foreign policy. To many observers, it sounds like a return to using old-fashioned moral language. But linguist Jeff Nunberg points out that evil doesn't mean what it used to.
This may be simply a sign of what a protected life I've led, but I don't think I've ever known anybody who was out and out evil. Well, actually, I knew an evil cat once. But that makes my point. Evil isn't something we ascribe to things in the familiar circle of our own experience. Evil has to be unfathomable, or it isn't evil. That's why a cat can be evil, and a dog can only be mean, because cats can be incomprehensible, whereas dogs wear their motivations on their collars. And that's why we tend to reserve the word evil for people who seem to have no rational motive for what they do, apart from a malignant pleasure in causing pain. Somebody like Ted Kaczynski, who holes up in a Montana cabin to build bombs and torture the local dogs. But when we can understand somebody's motivation, we tend to use other words. Those Enron executives who ripped off the company and its employees out of simple greed have been called immoral, corrupt, dishonest, or just plain sleazy. But nobody's thought to describe them as evil. When you think about it, in fact, it's odd that we should say that the love of money is the root of all evil, since we tend to assume that truly evil people aren't motivated by greed alone. But then, when that verse was inserted in the King James Bible, evil had a much broader meaning. It could refer to just about anything that was wrong, harmful, wretched, disagreeable, or merely unfortunate or defective. We may think of evil as a biblical word, but its meaning is a lot narrower for us than it was in the Bible itself, and narrower than most traditional theologians would have recognized. In fact, evil has become such a recondite notion for us that there are only a handful of modern contexts where we use the word at all. There's Nazi Germany, the model for evil in our time. And there are the fictional worlds of comic books, James Bond stories, and gothic movies like The Exorcist and The Omen. A lot of the time, in fact, the word has a decidedly campy tone. When I hear somebody use it, I can't help thinking of Richard Burton in The Exorcist saying, "We are in the presence of evil." Those echoes can be hard to escape even when somebody's trying to use the word in deadly earnest. President Bush has done everything he could to tie the word to bin Laden, to the point where he uses the evil one almost as a kind of pronoun. But if the label sticks, it's because bin Laden is a personification of evil right out of central casting, this creepy, exotic character who looks like he could have stepped out of a James Bond or Flash Gordon movie. you can hear the same campy resonances in the phrase axis of evil that Bush used in his State of the Union speech to refer to Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. Ari Fleischer said afterwards that Bush didn't intend any literal comparison to the Axis powers in World War II. I'll take Fleischer at his word on that, not just because the comparison is far-fetched, but because I suspect that for most listeners, that axis of evil phrase didn't evoke Churchillian echoes so much as a league of comic book supervillains. I can see the usefulness of the word evil. It's a tonic for the excesses of moral relativism. It cleaves neatly between us and them, and it simplifies the business of explaining why we fight. But as various commentators have observed, an absolute term like evil can be hard to square with the gradations and relativities that foreign policy is built around. That might not be much of an issue in the case of bin Laden himself. But once you try to extend the principle, you get into a situation where Colin Powell and Madeleine Albright are having public disagreements over whether North Korea should be classified as evil as opposed to merely awfully bad. Then, too, the Bush approach runs the risk of administering the coup de grace to the notion of evil itself, at least as a serious concept in American public life. Bush is obviously trying to turn the word into a catchphrase for his presidency. He used it 5 times in the State of the Union message and 10 times in a speech the following day in Florida. And in a speech in Winston-Salem, he expanded the war on evil to include parts of his domestic program, like the AmeriCorps volunteer initiatives. If you want to fight evil, he said, we figured out a way to do so militarily. But at home, you fight evil by doing something to help somebody. Nobody's about to question the value of home building and literacy tutoring, but that isn't what people generally have in mind when they talk about fighting evil, and a certain cynicism is likely to creep in. Buzzwords and catchphrases have a short half-life in American politics, and sooner or later, the war on evil will go the way of other political slogans, from a kinder, gentler nation to compassionate conservatism. This could be the end of evil as we know it, at least in American public life.
Jeff Nunberg is the author of The Way We Talk Now. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song by Dave Van Ronk, who was one of the leading figures of the Greenwich Village folk music scene of the 60s. He had colon cancer and died yesterday at the age of 65. Here's his 1963 recording of his song, He Was a Friend of Mine.
He was a friend of mine. He was a friend of mine. Never had no money, paid for his fine. He was a friend of mine. He died on the road. Died on the road. Never had no money pay for his bone. He was a friend of mine.
He Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Wisdom of Menopause, Creating Physical and Emotional Health and Healing During the Change by Dr. Christine Northrup. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Olympic athlete Chris Klug. He's competing in Salt Lake City as the top American snowboarder. Klug underwent a liver transplant just over a year ago and was back on the Alpine circuit within months. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.